What if you had a chance to go back and do something again? What if you lived your life with a degree of regret and fear and doubt over something which had occurred earlier? We all do that. What if this event had pushed you into a place that needed to be resolved within you? For most of us, we need to move forward. But what if you had the opportunity to go back in time and change it? Would you? If you could, how would you do it? Would you make it better for yourself? Or would you resolve the issues you had and make it better for everyone else? My name is Mike McCafferty. I do a podcast called I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek. And in 1996, the Star Trek franchise had an opportunity to do a do-over, to reintroduce beloved characters without being fettered by other characters or huge amounts of storyline. This is my movie dive on Star Trek First Contact. Kind of nailed that. Kind of nailed that one. So that's a keeper. You know, I do the openings for these podcasts a lot. I redo them a lot. And then I just go willy-nilly through the rest of it. But if I get a good one, I don't stop. Because openings are important. How you start is really important. And that's what this film showed us. That's one of the things, one of the first things I'll say is that this film starts out great and doesn't stop. All right, we're going to let this just fade out here. All right, so welcome. My name is Mike McCafferty, as previously prophesied. This is my podcast called I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek. Thank you for joining me. This is our summer of movie dives here. We are up to Star Trek First Contact, Star Trek 8. The dropping of the Roman numerals has occurred in the previous movie. But this is Star Trek 8, for those of you keeping track. Check out our Facebook page. Our Facebook page has become this ever-burgeoning place where people can kind of check in, and I post all sorts of weird, funny, ridiculous stuff. I always forget to read off people's reactions here, so let me do that right off the bat here. Michael Lawson says, Generations is the best Star Trek movie overall. Its intensity of Wrath of Khan, the fun of Voyage Home, and the pacing of Discovery, Undiscovered Country. Michael Mann says, great fun, holds up to rewatches due to excellent pacing. Tony Mayer says, the first Star Trek movie I saw in theaters. It was big, scary, and fun. Abed says, better than Generations in some parts, but still not up there with Khan. Aaron Moles had an interesting comment, which I will lean into. Entertaining. Cromwell adds fun to it. For all the talk of Picard being 25% different in the new show, we talked about this with Bad Robot, he's at least 25% different in this movie. And that's very insightful. I'm going to lean into that a lot and talk a lot about that. And he also point out too, plus he executes one of his crew members. We'll talk about that too. Zach says, second favorite Star Trek movie. Maria says, the first one I saw in theaters and probably my favorite of the TNG cast. Tony says, a really fun film to watch. Roger Dodger has some issues with it, but I'll let you read those, but he also loves it as well. And CC Crossland says, drive me insane with a lack of continuity regarding the number of decks and design of the phaser rifles. I grant you everything. So check out our Facebook page as well, because it is definitely becoming sort of the asterisk in my podcast. All right, so here we are, eighth film, seventh podcast I've done. I'm leaving Star Trek II as a sort of a sacred beast, which I will probably look at the end. My son, was watching in the other room last night, and like a siren song, like I walked in there and I started reciting the lines. I had to shut up because I just know that show so well. But I haven't watched First Contact in totality for a while. Sort of like Star Trek VI, I enjoyed this movie so much that sometimes you don't want to go back and rewatch a film for fear that it will not hold up as what you thought it would, as what you hoped it would. And that happened to a degree with Star Trek VI. I had a little some bugaboos here and there about that. I watched it about 2 years ago, really enjoyed it, watched it this year, had some caveats to my enjoyment, and you can go back and listen to that podcast. Very long podcast. We're going to try and keep this one shorter, And if we don't, I apologize. But this one, I will. You'll be pleased to know that I was pleased to have watched it at least twice now, and done my deep dive on it. So, let's just dig right in, shall we? Let's go into. We do this in three sections. We do the pre-production. We talk about how they came about the making of it. We talk about the actual movie. That's the longest beast of it, and then we talk about the post-production and my reactions on it. So, pre-production. Star Trek Generations was a financial success, but a critical failure. And it's hard to call it a critical failure because it was about a 2.5-star movie to a lot of critics. I mean, there are parts they liked, but overall, it was not a satisfying film to most of the fans and to critics alike. But it made $120 million back in 1992-ish. So it was inevitable that a sequel was on its way. This Generations had the death of Captain Kirk. Bill Shatner came in and said, I have an idea how to bring him back. And went into Sherry Lansing, president of Paramount, and Rick Berman and all these people, and pitched them this idea. And he did end up writing these books, these series of books, which I guess are pretty good. I think it's called The Return, where via Borg technology, he comes back to life. I'd never actually read them. When I read the synopsis, like, oh boy, this is different. I always thought Spock would save him. But through Borg technology, he comes back to life, and then he causes the destruction of the Borg, and then dies again. And Paramount said, isn't it? Well, I think Berman actually said, isn't it kind of chintzy that we bring him back just to kill him? Or you know, he just died, and now we're bringing him back, although that happened in Star Trek III, so there's definitely merit for that. But they basically paid him lip service. They were not going to bring back Kirk so quickly. They had a younger, cheaper cast of actors, which they wanted to focus on. So he went off and wrote those books, and I guess they're pretty successful. And if you, and maybe I should, I think probably of all the novels of Star Trek I want to read, and I don't want to read any of them, maybe it's these that I want to read the most because they do bring back Kirk. And maybe this may be the only time we're ever going to see him back. Brandon Braga and Ronald D. Moore are brought back to write after Generations. You know, it's sort of a mixed bag because they did All Good Things, which is this phenomenal finale to Star Trek. And then they kind of miff it in Generations. It's interesting. There's a two books called The 50 Years of Star Trek, and it's sort of an oral history. And if you read it up top, when they talk to them, when they interview them, they don't necessarily, they have all the ideas themselves how they want to write this. When you read it afterwards, after the movie's come out, and they're talking about First Contact, they talk about all of these stipulations that Paramount put on them. Oh, you have to have the original cast in, but only for the first 15 minutes. You have to have Whoopi Goldberg in here. You have to have this. You have to have that. So all of a sudden, from the beginning, from the inception of it, they seemed like, yeah, we're going to make this. We did this thing all ourselves. And then in retrospect, when it was looked at as a failure, they said, oh, yeah, Paramount gave us all these conditions. So I don't know where the truth is, and I don't really care that much. I just think it's interesting how we can retcon our own lives. We can go back in time and change events. But they're brought back, and they started thinking about things. And here's the thing, is that when you're making a story and you have the best material, you know, if you have a Batman movie, you got to put the Joker in. If you have a Superman movie, you got to put in Lex Luthor. You just have to do that. You can't be coy. You can't be cute. You can't create characters. Rick Berman is also quoted as saying, well, there was only one villain in Generations, only one villain. He kept on saying that, and he was a human, and he wasn't human. He's Elorian, and there was actually three with Thurston Bator. And oh, by the way, a tip of the hat to the actress who played Bator. Now, I don't have her name. God, I'm so sorry about that. I'll look it up in a minute. Who just passed away recently. But they wanted, if you're doing a show and you want to put on, if you're doing a party, you don't serve Doritos if you're trying to do a fancy party. You put your best china forward. And Star Trek's best china at this point in time was either Q, which they'd already used in the finale, or the Borg. The Borg had, from the best of both worlds, end of season 3 to season 4, had basically saved the franchise. Had saved that show and saved the franchise. And they were a terrifying, relentless villain, which they kind of messed up. We'll get back into that a little bit. But they were right there. And in generations, they skipped over them to create create Sorin and use kind of the B-team with Lursa and Bator. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. The Borg were definitely in this one. Because now they had a blank slate. Now Paramount said, do whatever you want, just make it good. So Brandon Braga and Ronald D. Moore and Rick Berman said, okay, let's make it the best thing we can. They came to the idea, I believe it was Moore and Braga came up with the idea of the Borg, and Rick Berman came up with the idea of time travel. And they met on the studio and they said, I have this idea, and became a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup of ideas. Some of the original time travel ideas were going back to the 1500s, Renaissance time, Civil War. And there's a quote here, in the Renaissance time, they tracked the Borg down to a castle near the village where a nobleman runs a feudal society. We suspect the Borg are working in there, but no one can get in. So Data, our spy, impersonates an artist's apprentice. Data becomes friends with Leonardo da Vinci, who at the time is working with the nobleman. You would have sword fights and phaser fights mixed together in the 15th century. It risked becoming really campy and over the top. I couldn't say that line. This is a quote from one of the writers with a straight face. I just can't imagine. What strange night is this? We are Borg. You know, I know not of this Borg feudal empire. In Civil War, I don't know. And the person who put the kibosh on this was Patrick Stewart. He said, no, I don't want to do this. Then they started looking around in their IP. Well, what can we do? What historical event can we hit? And because it's historical events that we know that nothing's changed. There are no stakes for this. It's like, oh no, you're going to assassinate Hitler. Well, in our world, that doesn't happen. So why even care about that? I mean, what are the stakes then if it's not changing history? They stumbled across the episode Metamorphosis, Star Trek. I believe it's season three. Original series with Zefram Cochrane, the man who created warp drive technology for Earthers. And they said, well, what if we dug into that? What if we do our future, but their history? And everyone was on board with that. They wanted to create a sort of nativity scene, basically for the creation of the Federation, the creation for the resurrection of humanity after the Third World War. That's coming up, folks. World War III is still coming up. Hang on to your hats. Eugenics War, we may have passed. 1996. Same year as this movie. So the story started to come together very quickly from that. Originally, Picard was going to be on the planet with a photographer. Lily was going to be a photographer. And Zefram Cochrane was going to be injured. And Picard was going to take the place of Zefram Cochrane. He was going to become basically the Abraham Lincoln and be the person who everyone sees. And so now when you open up your history books to see Zefram Cochrane, it's going to be Jean-Luc Picard. And Riker was going to be on board the ship fighting the Borg. Again, to the rescue comes Patrick Stewart, now really feeling himself, you know, getting into these X-Men movies, starting to, you know, doing, he's going to do Moby Dick in a couple years. He's really starting to come into his own. And he said, nope, let's switch it around. There's a subplot in this, a meta subplot, where Patrick Stewart really wants to become an action hero, and that will become fully formed in Nemesis, where he's driving on a dune buggy, and we'll talk about that. But these are the inklings of him really wanting to be an action star, which is too bad because it derails some of the stuff. But right now we're going to have a nice balance in this movie, and he appropriately said, we need to switch it. I need to face the Borg. Because Riker doesn't have that much invested in the Borg, but Jean-Luc Picard does. They had a Paramount, not Sherry Lansing. It was another guy, maybe he was like a vice president, loved Star Trek. And he was the one who came up to them and said, you know, the Borg are great. I've read your drafts, but they're just zombies. They're just zombies in space. You need to have a central villain for this. And that's where the Borg Queen came from. And I have mixed feelings about it, but I understand for the sake of a movie for, you know, 2 hours that this is a good idea. But that's where the Borg Queen came from. A-list directors were approached to direct this film. Ridley Scott, John McTiernan, diehard guy. They all turned it down. It's a franchise, and it's a niche franchise at that. So they began to solicit offers from the cast members. And I don't know who else threw their hat in the ring, but I've read that it was other cast members also. I'm sure it's probably Brent Spiner, maybe LeVar Burton, maybe Patrick Stewart. But out of all of those, they picked Jonathan Frakes. Again, the second in command is the first one in the director's chair. Jonathan Frakes had been directing a few episodes before, did a really good job. He found the balance of being able to be in the episode, although sometimes not as much, and direct his friends. And, you know, these franchise films, they didn't spend as much money as you'd think. This isn't like the Fast and Furious 7. They actually kept pretty tight purse strings on these movies, which sort of shows sometimes. Sometimes you're going, that looks a little chintzy. It's because Paramount never went full bore on this. They never said, okay, let's just go ahead and throw all the money we have at this and make this a huge movie. These were always expeditions. Can we make more money off this franchise? Well, can we make a little more? If we give it a little more money, we'll get a lot more money. Jonathan Frakes was a very cheap quote to get. So he was hired. Not only because he was cheap, but because, like Nimoy, he knew the nuances of the show. He was a person who had worked very closely with the cast. He knew all the lore, for lack of a better term. And so you're getting someone who has built-in knowledge, sort of like David Carson, although David Carson in Generations was problematic. But if you get a cast member who's been there every single episode, there is not a corner or a crevice that he's not going to know about as far as the Star Trek lore. And he was fast, too. This is where he's going to get his nickname as Two Takes Frakes. I mean, he would move. When I did the show The Invisible Man 20 years ago now, I worked with the writer, Craig Silverstein, and he directed a two-parter in the second season. He moved so fast. And he'd be like, okay, we got it. And I just said, Craig, I mean, you only did like two or three takes in this. Are you sure? And he's like, I wrote this. I know exactly how it's supposed to look, exactly how it's supposed to go. That was it. Jonathan Frakes knew everything about Star Trek. He knew when something was right or wrong. If the performance was good, let's move on. He also knew Alfre Woodward. Oh, Jesus. How can I say that word any wrong? Wronger. And so in hiring her, now he has a little bit of a... He knows almost everyone on the set now. He did his homework, too. He studied movies like Aliens, Close Encounters, Jaws, Blade Runner. You can see those, all of those working in the film. You can see kind of the moodiness of Aliens and Blade Runner. You can see Close Encounters and Jaws, the sense of wonder, and then the sense of dread with the monsters. Before the movie came out, some other titles were bandied around. Star Trek Resurrection. Sounds a little religious. Star Trek Borg. It's a little opaque to anyone who's not ever seen Star Trek. Star Trek First Contact seems like something you can almost get your hands around and say, oh, maybe that's what I want to see. And so with a budget of $45 million, and again, I believe Generations is maybe $42 million. So they are really keeping a tight lid on this. Production began in April 8th, 1996. Finished July 2nd, only 2 days over. They had to do a couple of reshoots here and there just to kind of bump up the scary. But overall, things went really well on set. In fact, one of the things I have problems with in digging into this movie and going into the backstory is that I didn't find a lot of miscellaneous stories of, ugh, this was a disaster, this went wrong, I wish we would have done this, or this character didn't work out. By and large, this shoot went exceedingly smoothly. But as I've talked about before, in Star Trek, the odd-numbered films set up the even-numbered ones. All the mistakes are made in the odd-numbered films, and then the even-numbered ones benefit. And one of the mistakes that was corrected was to get someone who knew everything about Star Trek into that seat, and to do what they do best, which is to do shows about their scariest villains. This movie was released in November 22nd, 1996. It's still fascinating to me how quickly you can turn around a movie these days when you see Marvel movies which are announced 3, 4, 5 years out in the development process. These movies, they just clipped them out. And so if you got a good or bad movie, one of the processes you can look to is the development, which was, these are very, very quick. If you look, there's an old teaser trailer, and I'll post this on the Facebook page probably, before the movie came out, with a different take of Picard saying, "The line must be drawn here." And also a shot of Voyager fighting the Borg. So if you were in, and this is only in the UK where it came out. So if you're in the UK, you're like, "Blimey, it looks like Janeway's fighting the Borg." All right. That was part one. Part two. Let's get into the movie. We start out, of course, with Jerry Goldsmith's beautiful music, one of my favorite themes. Although Star Trek V is creeping up on me a little bit, and I do like 6. I mean, I love them all. Well, no, I don't love them all. I'm not a fan of 4. Four's growing on me. Not a fan of 9. Oof. 10, not so much. But this has a beautiful theme. Jonathan Frakes gets billing over Brent Spiner as an actor. Interesting. I would have thought that Spiner might get a billing over him, considering he has a larger story. But, you know, maybe just goes by chain of command. The titles fly away from the camera. Instead of flying at us, they fly backwards as though we're going back in time. I like that. The titles are getting shorter. Everything's being truncated now in movies. As we hit the 90s, a new paradigm for how to make a movie is emerging, and this is part of it. Now, in Generations, we had a prologue, essentially 18 minutes of sort of the original series cast and then the Enterprise B cast screwing around with Nexus nonsense, sort of a prologue to set the table. This, no. And this is what I love about this movie. We jump right into a flashback slash nightmare of Captain Jean-Luc Picard in the Borg cube, which has circles inside of it. I never realized that. Being assimilated, having a drill right next to his eye. Oh, it's so gross. He wakes up from this horrible dream, goes to wash his face, and then a Borg thing comes out of his face. It's a double dream. It's like an Inception dream. But this gets us moving. Already we know what we're looking at, what we're afraid of. I love how this opens up. And then from right there, he gets a message within a minute saying, Jean-Luc Picard, the Borg are coming back, and he knows it. And boom, we're right into it. This is a different way of telling stories now. This is front-loading a movie with really exciting stuff and then going back and catching up with exposition, generally as you move forward. It is a different paradigm. If you see movies like 5 or 4, there's a lot of setup. Star Trek 4 has 25 minutes of setup before we get into the fun stuff. Before we go back in Earth, it's like 27 minutes, and it's just a lot of... Audiences have become more savvy, and we want to see the fun up front. So that's some of the fun. That is the promise of zombies, space zombies coming up. We get to see the new ship, the Enterprise-E, built very quickly, right? Built very quickly. A beautiful, like a saber-like ship, like a spearhead. Very different from the Enterprise-D, which is sort of like, Enterprise-D almost looked like it had weight issues, because it was always pushing out to the sides. And this one, it's like it's trimmed down. It's almost like it's movie spaceship, movie Enterprise. You know, everyone, a lot of these actors, like especially in Generations and First Contact, a lot of these guys, they lost a ton of weight and they look fit and trim because they want to be on a big screen, look good. And that's the same thing that happened with the Star Trek Enterprise-E. But it looks great. And they got new outfits, too. No more wearing of Sisko's old outfit. No! Everyone gets their own new outfit. I love it. And Geordi gets new eyes! Yes! So LeVar Burton had campaigned for years to get rid of that visor. And if you look at it in HD now, boy, it looks terrible. You can just see, like, if you look at it in Generations, you can just see it's just like this combination of plastic and, like, you know, the paint's on it. It just doesn't look good. You can see his eyes through it at one point in time. It's like, oh, hello, LeVar. So he gets new eyes. He gets new space eyes. So good for him. All right, I'm going to start playing some clips here. Forgive me if the I'm out here in the garage again. The internet's very slow, but I want to play this. So let's just set the stage here. So he's Picard is still haunted by the Borg. And Riker comes in. And the Borg are coming, but they tell them that they can't go. They're going to patrol the neutral zone.
Berlioz, what do you have? We finished our first sensor sweep of the neutral zone.
Oh, fascinating. 20 particles of space dust per cubic meter, 52 ultraviolet radiation spikes, and a class 2 comet. Wow, this is certainly worthy of our attention.
Captain, why are we out here chasing comets?
Let's just say that Starfleet has every confidence in the Enterprise and her crew. They're just not sure about her captain. They believe that a man who was once captured and assimilated by the Borg should not be put in a situation where he would face them again.
Okay, so here's a little bit of movie time retconning here. Because if you've watched the series, that immediately sticks out to you. That's the first... When they say that, you're like, huh, that doesn't make any sense. First of all, should Picard have been relieved of duty for a little while after he was assimilated by the Borg? Hell yes. He should have had a lot of therapy. He should have gone through PTSD, decompression, whatever it is. Instead, everyone gets shore leave and he gets to go out and go cry with his brother in a vineyard. It's strange how this man basically becomes an agent of the most fearsome enemy and is allowed to be the captain of the flagship with no further worries about him. Starfleet is worried about Picard because he's been assimilated by the Borg. They want to pull him out of this. And yet, he's dealt with the Borg a couple of times with Hugh, and then in the episode's Descent with the Borg and with Lore. It just doesn't track for someone who really enjoys Star Trek that Starfleet would be pulling him out. So whenever I watch this film, I sort of retcon it myself and I say, you know what? Let's pull all those Borg episodes out. Let's just pretend that this is somewhere in the middle of season 4 or that those other Borg episodes never happened. I would like to do that anyways. But that's not going to happen because Hugh's going to come back and Picard. So, but if we do that, then all of this tracks. Because by their own admission, you know, Berman and Brannen and Moore said, we wanted to get past Picard's, like, his trauma of the Borg. So the very next episode, he resolves it. He fights with his brother, Robert, who then burns in a fire. You know, sorry. But he comes to a sort of a piece of this. But when we see him in this movie, it has been reset, basically. He is not okay with the Borg anymore. It still haunts him. And that's one of those movie things we're just going to have to be okay with. All right, so we get on the bridge. We see Lieutenant Hawk. Supposedly was supposed to be the first gay character, but they cut it out. We have Data saying to hell with the orders, a kind of callback to Spock in Star Trek VI. And then the Enterprise goes from the neutral zone to Earth. I don't know if I have a problem with this. I mean... This is movie magic. If you want to see a really fast warp speed, get them from the neutral zone to Earth, or get the Enterprise from the middle of the Federation to the center of the galaxy. That's even faster. That's movie plot logic. Again, is this for the fans or is this for the larger audience? Probably for the larger audience. They were kind of tucked away someplace, and they've made the decision to go join the fight. Now, I mean, maybe if they're in the Typhon Expanse, it took the Borg a couple of days to get there, and the Enterprise was able to meet them there. But regardless, they get there. But this movie is still only... We are 10 minutes into this film, and we've got a Borg battle. Yes! This is what we want! Let's get to it. Let's get to this kick-ass Borg battle. It's a good battle, too. Lots of new ships... The Millennium Falcon flies by. This is true. ILM stuck it in there for a couple of frames. Someday Disney will buy up Paramount, and then there will be Star Trek versus Star Wars, and with the Avengers on it, and with Pokemon and superheroes, and whatever else we want, and Ghostbusters and Harry Potter, and we'll all be like tethered up to Disney Plus with giant tubes coming out of our heads because resistance is futile with them. Oh. And let's all note that the word futile is a British pronunciation, and in America we say futile, until we're talking about the Borg, and then it's futile. Hey, are you grouting? Are you fixing up your bathroom? Well, I went down to the hardware store, but it turns out I have futile. Whew, that was terrible. All right, moving on. So, we had the Bozeman as well in this fight with Kelsey Grammer. It's always been mentioned that maybe Kelsey Grammer has a cameo of that, a vocal cameo. Maybe Nichelle Nichols also, too. And then we show up and we see the Defiant. The Defiant! And if you don't know anything about Star Trek, you're like, who cares about this? But for the first time now, Star Trek is trying to do kind of a MCU Star Trek universe, shared universe, by having Deep Space Nine a little bit in it. And also a little bit of Voyager and a little bit of Enterprise. We have the Defiant with Worf on it. The way that Worf gets in these films after being on Deep Space Nine becomes increasingly more ridiculous. Next episode, he's going to be part of some sort of conference, or I don't know what the hell's going on. But he's on the Defiant with Adam Scott from Parks and Rec. And this ship was supposed to, it was built to fight the Borg. That's why it was there. It was supposed to fight the Borg, and then it was repurposed to fight the Dominion. It fails. It does terribly. I don't know if they were looking at a swarm mentality or if this little ship was strong enough to defeat the Borg, but it doesn't. It fails. And so the Enterprise has to roll in and kind of save them and beam them up. I do have a question of... Oh, let's play this, actually. Let's get to this. Because speaking of that, as he beams us... As he beams aboard, here we go... We finally have the whole team together. And here comes the internet. Got it.
What?
I can hear them.
I have a patient here who insists on coming to the bridge.
Welcome aboard the Enterprise here, Mr. Worf.
Thank you, sir. The Defiant.
Adrift, but salvageable.
Tough little ship.
Little?
Mr. Worf, we could use some help at tactical.
You do remember how to fire phasers.
Okay, let's unpack a little bit of that, so because there's a lot of weird, interesting stuff going on here. So... Worf, through a series of circumstances, although other ships are blowing up left and right, they do decide to beam up the Defiant crew. The Defiant is not destroyed, but so we have Worf. Now we have our Worf because he's on Deep Space Nine, but now we have our Worf, we have our full crew. We ask about the Defiant. The Defiant should be destroyed, right? But it's made salvageable. This is because the producers of Deep Space Nine said, don't destroy our ship. It's our ship, please. So they make pains to say that the ship has been salvageable. And they don't really mention this at all in Deep Space Nine. So it is kind of like a forgotten moment there. What I like about this little exchange here, tough little ship there, little. And then Riker asks him, you still know how to fire phasers, right? What I enjoy about this is just a minor moment. But this is contextual character comedy. That's the three C's, right? Contextual character comedy. In Generations, we had a lot of weird, awkward set pieces, Mr. Tricorder, bits where the comedy was forced, bits where they're on the old Enterprise and they remove the gangplank, and they're fun. But they are forced pieces of comedy that don't necessarily jibe up with what we know of our characters. They do the same thing in Insurrection when they're singing Gilbert and Sullivan. We'll get to that later. What I like about these is that they are asides to characters who are doing their jobs, who work well together, and have just enough time. They're good enough that they can trade jabs and have a little bit of fun. It's sort of like the old Marvel, and maybe this is why Marvel movies are so good, because you remember in the Marvel team-ups when Spider-Man was fighting alongside Captain America, and as they're fighting, they can trade little quips and jabs, but they're still doing their job, which they're really, really good at. They're not stopping to do Mr. Tricorder or sing Gilbert and Sullivan or to be on old sailing ships. It's just little things here and there. Think about like Guardians of the Galaxy. Think about Iron Man, where they're doing their stuff, and these little things kind of pop in and out. They don't stop everything to try to create comedy. Create comedy as you go. So I just wanted to point that out. That's what made me really, really happy. They destroy the Borg ship. Question, why doesn't the Borg send 50 Borg cubes? We know in Voyager that there's like thousands of them floating around the Delta Quadrant. Why not just send all of your Borg cubes there and just assimilate the Earth, assimilate the Federation? Why not just, like, if you can have all these interspatial rifts, just take over everything? But they send one. Now, there is an argument that perhaps the Borg are farming new species. So I will entertain thoughts to that, but that's for a longer trip, a longer discussion. All right, so the Borg are destroyed because Picard is actually an asset to the Federation. Hello, he's the only person who's been in a Borg ship. He knows how they work. Why don't you put him in command? He gets put in command because the Admiral's ship is destroyed, but somehow the Admiral lives, and for, you know, Voyager episodes later on. All that aside, he figures out how to destroy the Borg ship. Boom, destroyed. Except a Borg sphere escapes. Fear the sphere, right? And makes its way towards Earth. They chase after it. It creates a chronoton thingamajig, which allows it to go back in time. And as the Enterprise is in the slipstream, they see that, oh no, they've turned the entire planet to Borg. So they have no choice but to follow them because they're being shielded by the slipstream. There's a lot of groundwork had to be laid here in order to make all this understandable. And they have to go back in time and stop the Borg. Now, I will tell you right now that this is still... We are 13 minutes in this film. Outstanding. Get it going. Move. Let's go. We show up in Bozeman, Montana, which is actually the Los Angeles National Forest. It's sort of a... They figured out that they're actually in our future, 2063, April 4th, right before Zefram Cockrum is going to make his epic space flight using warp technology. And they have to stop the Borg before they destroy the missile complex. I'm going to stop everything for 1 second here because we see Bozeman, Montana, and we have this kind of innocuous scene in a bar with Zefram Cochrane and Lily Sloan coming out, but they say goodnight to the bartender, and that bartender is actually a man by the name of Michael Zaslow. Michael Zaslow was crewman Darnell in The Man Trap. He's the first person Bones ever said he's dead Jim to. He was also Jordan in I, Mud. He also won an Emmy in Guiding Light. And here he is doing an uncredited cameo. It's kind of cool. I just wanted to stop it there. He passed away a few years after, but that's a little bit of history you get there. All right, so they are attacked by the Borg, who are trying to destroy Zefram Cochrane. I love this attack because there's a guy in a BMX bike trying to bike away, and an explosion hits, and he flips ass over tea kettle. I will never be upset with people trying to escape on BMX bikes and having to do stunt work. I'm kidding on that, but it's the most ridiculous thing. I love that scene. So they get away. They destroy the Borg sphere. And then they go on the planet to try to ascertain who's still left. They find Lily. She passes out. They have to beam her to the ship in order to save her. And here's another little section I want to play after that, after they figured out that they're going to have to make sure that this ship launches. It's at 2110. For those of you following along, here we go. All right, well, 2103, we'll start. So, and here we go.
The ship has to be launched. Picard to engineering.
LaForge here.
Geordi, Cochrane's ship was damaged in the attack. Get down here with an engineering detail. We have work to do.
Right. I'm on my way, Captain. Alpha team, let's assemble in transporter room 3. We're heading down to the surface. Porter. You're going to be in command till I get back.
Aye, sir.
And Porter, check out the environmental controls while I'm gone. It's getting a little warm in here. All right, let's go.
Right.
All right, so I went a little back. Went a little back in time here. So that's a good scene, too, there. But they're here at the missile complex, and now Picard and Data are looking at the missile.
Isn't it amazing? This ship used to be a nuclear missile.
It is an historical irony that Dr. Cochrane would choose an instrument of mass destruction to inaugurate an era of peace.
Picard puts his hand on the missile.
Boyhood fantasy, Data. I must have seen this ship hundreds of times in the Smithsonian, but I was never able to touch it.
Sir, does tactile contact alter your perception of Phoenix?
Oh, yes. For humans, touch can connect you to an object in a very personal way, make it seem more real.
Data puts his hand on it.
Detecting imperfections in the titanium casing. Temperature variations in the fuel manifold. It is no more real to me now than it was a moment ago.
Would you three like to be alone?
Okay, so thank you for indulging me on that longer clip. It was actually 21, I was at 20. Lots of good things here. We end with a nice little bit of comedy. It's just, you know, two guys touching a rocket. The moment I wanted to point out is that here we have Picard being Picard. Maybe for the first time in the movie franchise for him. The Picard we saw in Generations was hounded by this sort of created tragedy of the death of Robert and René. But here we see him the way we loved him in the Seasons, where he's a teacher. And he's an explorer, he's an archaeologist, and all comes to a head here when he can actually put his hand on a piece of history. We also get the beginnings of Data's story, which is that as human as he tries to be, he still can't understand what it means to have a tactile sensation create an emotional feeling. The way we do when we see something, we smell something that creates a nostalgic feel or creates an excitement, he still can't have that. And that will play forth further when the Borg Queen shows up. All right, so we get Zefram Cochrane here coming up. Well, first, the Borg start to do their mischief on board the ship. Picard beams up onto the ship as the Borg are starting to attack. So we have a weird crossing. As I told you before, originally Riker was going to be on the ship and Picard was going to be on the surface. And this is where the script switches to what Patrick Stewart wanted. So it's a little bit of a strange crisscross where Picard beams down, then beams back up, then Riker beams down. But it gets Picard to at least experience some of the stuff that's going on down below, because from this point on, he's going to be stuck on the ship, and Riker's going to be stuck down below. The Borg start taking over the ship, and this is where we have... Let me see where I can put it. All right, so let me play this, because this is kind of an interesting moment here that's going to harken back to our good friend, Aaron Moles. Friend of the pod. Oh, this internet speed, it's killing me. It's killing me, but it's a Sunday, and... Well, here we go.
Why without their organic components?
I have ordered all weapons to be set on a rotating modulation. The Borg will adapt quickly. We will be able to fire 12 shots at most.
One other thing. You may encounter Enterprise crew members who've already been assimilated. Don't hesitate to fire. Believe me, you'll be doing them a favor.
Okay, so this is the 25% that Aaron was talking about. This is movie Picard. This Picard now is a man of action, and he is haunted by this idea that these crew members can't be saved, which we all know to be ridiculous, right? I mean, he was saved. I mean, in episode one of season four, Beverly takes away all of his, everything that made him a Borg, all of his implants. But here, because we need to have, there can't be, all right, we need to capture them, we need to sedate them, we need to keep them in a holding pen. No, this is a movie, they're bad guys, we need to dispatch them. So this is one of the things that bumps up. It's also building forth this conflict that we're going to be coming to with Picard. Again, in Generations, we didn't have a very strong conflict for Picard. He was feeling remorse and regret. He wasn't feeling a desire for vengeance or the fact that he had been wronged or he had PTSD. Here he does. So the writers, and again, these are Star Trek writers, are leaning into this idea that he has not recovered from this. And in fact, he has turned into a different person because of this. Is this our Jean-Luc Picard? Maybe 75%. The other thing I need to play for you is the way Worf says, weapons. And I like that because in Family Guy, they go through a long, you know, Will Wheaton.
I want contact.
Just listen to him say
weapons.
But the
Borg are not entirely organic.
True, but like all cybernetic life forms, they cannot survive without their organic components.
I have ordered all weapons to be set on...
All weapons. You can listen to my entire podcast and hate everything else, but you have to love that. All right, so moving forward. All weapons. They go into the ship. Oh, let's actually, before we get to that, let's talk about Zaffron Cochrane. Zaffron Cochrane. I have a friend named Dennis Cochrane who was on Star Trek, and sometimes I mix that up. So here we meet, finally, Zaffron Cochrane, and let's play this as well. Here. Okay, so we find Deanna in a bar. She's drunk. Riker shows up.
Who is this jerk? No call to make a turn off my music.
Will Riker? Zaffron Cochrane.
Big friend of yours?
Yes.
Husband?
No.
Good. Now this, Deanna.
Deanna.
This is the good stuff.
Dr. Cochrane.
To the Phoenix. May she rest in peace.
Yeah, drink. It's terrible.
Okay. That wasn't so good.
Well, I think we have to tell him the truth.
If we tell the truth, the timeline...
Timeline? This is no time to argue about time. We don't have the time. What was I saying?
You're drunk.
I am not.
Yes, you are.
Look, he wouldn't even talk to me unless I had a drink with him. And then it took 3 shots of something called tequila just to find out he was the one we're looking for. And I've spent the last 20 minutes trying to keep his hands off me. So don't go criticizing my counseling technique.
Sorry.
It's a primitive culture. I'm just trying to blend in.
You're blended, all right.
There we go. Ah, so much there to unpack. Let's go backwards. "You're blended all right" is a really funny tag onto that. Deanna Troi, funny. We have never seen Deanna be funny. And in fact, Jonathan Frakes went to Marina and said, don't be funny. Every time she tried to be funny, she talks about it. She's like, I tried to be funny in the series, and every time it would always fail terribly. This is a funny scene for her. I know Roger Dodger doesn't like it, but I like it. I think it's, again, this is character-centered. This is her trying to do her job, and it, in doing so, gets drunk, and then has to tell off Will Riker that she's doing her job. I like this scene also because they get right to it, and they say, we have to tell him. There's no subterfuge. In Star Trek IV, there was a little bit of subterfuge with Dr. Gilliam, and then they finally tell her, time travel, let's just do it. Let's just all jump on board. What I also want to talk about here is Zefram Cochrane. Now, Cochrane. Now, if you have seen Metamorphosis, and I suggest that you at least skim through some of it, you'll notice that Zefram Cochrane from the original series does not look like James Cromwell. In fact, James Cromwell is probably like 6'5". He towers over Will Riker, for God's sakes. Oscar nominated at the time for Babe. Not Babe, Pig in the City, but Babe. James Cromwell was a good get for this. At first, I had problems because I knew Metamorphosis so well, but I also wasn't a big fan of that actor. Now, he passed away in 1993 of lung cancer, so there was no way he could be in this film anyways. But here we have this character, and Tom Hanks was approached to play this role, but he was doing That Thing You Do, the movie, not That Thing You Do. And in Metamorphosis, Zefram Cochrane starts out in Alpha. He's born in Alpha Centauri, which is like, then how did he get to Alpha Centauri? There's a lot of stuff which doesn't make sense in that TOS. So I'm okay changing him and changing a little bit of his output. And I like James Cromwell's performance in this movie. I mean, he is wild. He's insane. He's a drunk. The one thing I will point out, and maybe you guys don't have a problem with this, but after watching it several times, is I never see any level of genius on Zefram Cochrane in this. I don't see the Metamorphosis that much either. But a man who creates warp field technology from nothing, basically, after World War III, has to be something of a genius. Now, maybe he's an entrepreneur like Edison or Tesla, or not Tesla, Elon Musk. But he built these things to some degree. Or maybe his scientists did, but there has to be... I never see a moment where we see his intellectual greatness. One time has to look at an intermix formula from Geordi. Anyway, that's my one pet peeve about this. Otherwise, he's a lot of fun, and it's an interesting take on the character. All right, Alfred Woodward is in this film as well. And she is phenomenal. In Generations, we have great actors as well. But, boy, they nailed the casting on this. I should point out that we have a sort of prolonged sequence with Worf and Picard and Data, where Data turns off his emotion chip, and the Borg start to attack them, and then Picard kills one of his own crewmen because he is being assimilated by the Borg. This is a big problem. This is a big problem in this movie, which we'll have to come back to at some point in time. But let's move on a little bit to Alfre Woodward, who is an outstanding actress at this, and a wonderful compliment to Jean-Luc Picard. Alfre has a difficult task in this, and I believe another one of Roger Dodger's criticisms, which to some degree I completely agree with, is that she is saddled with so much exposition. But I contend that because this is a movie, and this is going out to many people who have never watched Star Trek before, we need someone who's going to be a gateway. In Generations, we didn't have that. In Generations, it's absolutely bonkers. There are four Enterprises. There are three casts. There are Klingons. There's Sauron. There's Whoopi Goldberg. Who the hell are we paying attention to if you've never seen this film? It is absolute gobbledygook. The brilliance of having a character follow another character around, especially in a time travel movie, is that they become our eyes and our ears. And we get Picard explaining to Alfre what's going on, catching her up and the audience up. As I said earlier, because we skip over a lot of the exposition in the early part of the movie, we owe it at some point in time. And here's where we pay the piper as he's starting to walk around with Alfre, captures him and takes him around to try to escape. She thinks she's with the Eastern faction. She has the unenviable task of asking all these questions about where she is and why she is, and then also starting to put together an argument against Jean-Luc Picard. I want to play this wonderful little sequence here, and these sequences are long in this movie that I'm playing for you, longer than some of the other ones I've played in the past, but they're just so damn good. This is when Picard takes Lily to the observation deck here to show her that they're actually out in space.
Orbiting the Earth at an altitude of three...
You want to help me? Get me out of here!
All right. You want a way out? Here it is.
Opens the door to see the window...
What is this?
...showing Earth.
Australia, New Guinea, Solomons. Montana will be up soon, but you may want to hold your breath. It's a long way down. Now listen to me. I'm not your enemy, and I can get you home. But first, you must put that weapon down and trust me.
Jean-Luc Picard. My name. That's my name. What's yours?
Lily.
Welcome aboard, Lily. Thank you.
Picard looks at the phaser.
Maximum setting. If you fired this, you would have vaporized me.
It's my first ray gun.
What I like about this scene here, first of all, is that, again, Alfre Woodard is so good at being both tough and vulnerable in this. She's a badass when she's got the phaser. When Picard shows her that she's on a spaceship orbiting Earth, she's terrified. There's a little moment where she's gripping onto the railing as Picard leads her to take a look at the Earth a little closer. And she's gripping on so hard, it's like a white knuckle moment, and she has to grab onto his hand. She has so much freight to carry in this film, but she does it so expertly. So as I said, so now she's informing the audience about what Star Trek is. They're in the future. She's in our future, but his past. And now she's also, from this point on, as he starts to explain what the Borg is and his relationship to them, she's going to start taking on the information of his emotional journey. She is an emotional match for Jean-Luc Picard because she's tough, and she's smart, and she has an emotional openness that she can challenge him, and she will. But from this point on, she is gathering evidence about that. Okay, great scene. And it's my first ray gun. It's such a... Again, she goes from, I'm going to destroy you, to, I'm just a little kid now. Beautiful. All right, so from there, we get into Data being captured, and now we have, dear God, the Borg Queen. Let's just get into some Borg Queen here, too. There we go. Played by Alice Krieg, South African. Great in this. She was also in the movie Ghost Story. Yes, I'm stalling so that my internet will catch up, and here we go.
Somehow, I question your motives.
That is because you haven't been properly stimulated yet.
You have reactivated my emotion chip. Why?
Don't be frightened.
I'm not frightened.
He's got a little piece of skin on his arm.
Do you know what this is, Data?
It would appear you were attempting to graft organic skin onto my endoskeletal structure.
What a cold description for such a beautiful gift.
She blows on it, and the skin gets little goosebumps.
Was that good for you?
Oh, God, yes, that was good for me. So, as I said before, when I saw the Borg Queen, and they tease it out in a lot of the trailers, I had very mixed feelings about it. I love the Borg because they are so impersonal. As Roger Dodger pointed out, they are such an impersonal, relentless army ant, zombie kind of force, which you can destroy one or 50 or 1,000, they'll still keep coming. There's no centralization. But here, they've created a central figure, a central foe. This was a good choice. For years, I was very much on the fence, but it's a good choice because it does bring into focus what the bad guys' plans are. The bad guys have many not well-executed plans, but by having a central figure as the Borg Queen, it allows us to focus in on what their plans are. Now, she is not leading the audience or leading the show. We talked about Soren, we've talked about Cybok, where these characters, the show's about them, the movie's about them, because they're always the ones who are moving forward with their plot, and it's up to our heroes to play defense and try to stop them. But we don't want to stop them because they're trying to do something really cool. Here, the Borg are in charge, and all they're trying to do, we've already seen the outcome, which is they've turned the planet into a Borg. It's a brilliant strategy because we know what the stakes are. We already know what happens if they succeed. Now, we have to go on a quest as our heroes, a heist basically, it's a time heist essentially, to stop them. She's playing defense. The centralization of a Borg queen also allows us to split our characters off. Dr. Soren, as good as Roddy McDowall was, he had to be the nemesis for Patrick, for Jean-Luc Picard, Captain Kirk, Data, Geordi, everybody. Lursan Vator, they were just along for the ride. So he has to service all these guys. Now, with the Borg Queen, we can have Data go along with her, and she tries to tempt him. Tempt him with the power of the flesh. This is also another good move as far as Data's B story. In the Generations B story, he willingly placed his emotional chip inside his head and then couldn't turn it off. So it's sort of his fault for all this. Here he turns off the chip, but she turns it back on because she wants to give him the idea of what it means to be this half man, half robot. He has always tried to be a full boy, a real boy. And the Borg say, we can give you the best of both worlds. That title finally kind of fits now, doesn't it? It's a wonderful seduction of Data. It's not him stumbling around with emotions. It's him being forced to feel these experiences and choose between the seductive power she's offering him and his friends. Alice Krieg is phenomenal at this. This was a painful costume, painful contacts. She could only wear those contacts for 4 minutes, but she is great in this. I don't know if it was someone else who was mustache twirling, certainly on a woman, be weird, but if they were more over the top, I don't know, but she conveys a sexuality in this, which I didn't think was possible. I've gone too far. All right. Meanwhile, we have Picard and Lily on another part of the Enterprise as they're pursuing our A story, basically, which is Picard's redemption, his basically trying to overcome his need for revenge upon these creatures. And we have our midpoint musical moment. I have an MFA in screenwriting, and dear God, I'm so sorry to push this upon you, but if you watch most movies, in the middle of the movie, you're going to have a musical moment where there's music with the characters and they're getting what they think they want. And it is kind of a ridiculous setting. Can we just all be okay with that? He needs to get a piece from a Borg, so he goes into a holodeck, creates a Dixon Hill novel, gets the wrong chapter, gets the right chapter, gets him and Lily into outfits, gets them to dance and not look like they're being like weird about it, steals a Tommy gun from Nikki the Nose, shoots the Borg, and then pulls out the device. That's a lot of work. Computer, give me a Tommy gun. Computer, make a giant foot that crushes the Borg. It's an excuse for a really cool set piece. And that's all I'm going to say about it because it is a really cool set piece. I kind of dig it. It's really nice. Ethan Phillips is in it. He plays a major D. He had to audition for it. Neelix had to audition for this. And a shout out also to the Doctor, Robert Picardo, as the EMH. That was a nice little thing. But Ethan Phillips, they made him audition. So crazy. And he got it. He said, I didn't care. I had nothing to worry about. But it's nice to see him, see Picard in his kind of Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom tux dancing with Alfie Woodward, who looks great. I wish Alfie knew about Dixon Hill novels. That would have brought them closer together. That's just a little thing right there. Picard kills another crew member, and Lily gets to watch it this time. And she says, tough luck. But it's what this serves is to give Lily more ammunition, Tommy gun, for her later conversation with him. Okay, meanwhile, on the surface, we've reached our midpoint, and now things are going to start going downhill a little bit for their plans. I got to be honest, this is two movies, isn't it? There is Aliens on the ship. And maybe there's risky business with Data and the Borg Queen. And then there's just this delightful little summer movie on the surface, because no one is that concerned about what's going on in the Enterprise. They can't contact them, but they're just running around making sure Zefram Cochrane gets off, you know, on the Phoenix and makes sure the history is all fine. As you run quickly through this movie, you don't notice it. But then when you stop, you say, man, these guys are just having a good time on the planet. It's sort of like Generations, where after they pick up Picard in the deleted scene, he says, I heard you had some problems with the Klingons. Oh, yeah, about that. The Enterprise is destroyed. They're screwing around. You've got Barclay and Geordi and everyone, you know, just having a good time, you know, being so in awe of Zefram Cochrane. Meanwhile, all their friends are being assimilated on the spaceship. So, all right. So where are we here? So we get the Nick in the Nose thing. We have kind of a fun scene here with Barclay and with Zefram finally realizing that he's going to have to be an important character. Ooh, I just got an email from Armin. And we're going to put that in there a little bit. And that's where he starts to leave. He starts to run off. And then we get a little bit into the woods here. Not the Los Angeles mountains here, but my least favorite sequence, which is the deflector dish sequence. This is about an 8-minute sequence, 13 minutes all told from when they start to when they finish without any interludes, where they have to stop the Borg from making this interplexing beacon with the deflector dish. Otherwise, they'll summon the Borg from the Delta Quadrant, blah, 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 blah. It is a set piece which is one of the Borg's many plans that they need to stop. But to me, it feels superfluous. It feels like it's too much. Now, I get it. It's fun. You get to get them in their you know, spaceship costumes, and they're walking upside down, and they got wire work, and you got Borgs in space, and you get Worf saying, assimilate this, which, you know, was kind of cheesy even back then. I'm sorry, it was. I mean, what is he assimilating? You know, like, assimilate my penis. I didn't understand that. It really, I'm not playing any segments from it, but it is just this long sequence that doesn't really move the plot forward. All it does is like, okay, we stopped that. We plugged that hole, but the Borg have several more strategies. They can blow up the ship, the Phoenix. They can corrupt Data. They can take over the Enterprise. They can land back down the planet. I mean, they have lots of other things. This was just, it just felt like they wanted to have an action sequence. Okay, there you go. What we get back to is the Borg Queen. I'm sorry, what is the exact time code here? 1 hour, 3 minutes, and 30 seconds. The Borg Queen tempting Data.
Believing oneself to be perfect is often the sign of a delusional mind.
Burn.
Small words from a small being trying to attack what he doesn't understand.
Double burn.
I understand that you have no real interest in me, that your goal is to obtain the encryption codes for the Enterprise computer.
That is one of our goals, one of many. But in order to reach it, I'm willing to help you reach yours.
He breaks out this weird chair, punches some Borg, punches some more Borg, put a force field around him, and then they cut his skin. He doesn't like it.
Is it becoming clear to you yet? Look at yourself, standing there cradling the new flesh that I've given you. If it means nothing to you, why protect it?
I am simply imitating the behavior of humans.
You're becoming more human all the time, Data. Now you're learning how to lie.
My programming was not designed to process these sensations.
Then tear the skin from your limb as you would a defective circuit. Go ahead, Data. We won't stop you. Do it. Don't be tempted by flesh. Are you familiar with physical forms of pleasure?
If you are referring to sexuality, I am fully functional, programmed in multiple techniques.
How long has it been since you've used them?
8 years. 7 months, 16 days, 4 minutes, 22...
Far too long.
All right, so Data's seduction is complete here. And as we move from the midpoint to the second half of the second act, our characters are going further and further into lower spots. And here he realizes he has become like a slave to the wants of the flesh, both like on his arm and also just her temptations. It's a great scene here. It's a great moment here for Data. We get humor. We get him diving deeper into what it means to be a human. And it's all organic, pardon the phrase, for our Data that we know. All right, so after the deflector dish sequence, let's see. We lose Ensign Hawk. I had read that, or someone, one of them said we wanted to establish a character and then take him away, so it'd be a shock. We thought we wanted to set up as though he was going to be someone who's going to occur in more movies, and we took him away. It's Neil McDonough, and he's had quite a storied career afterwards. I don't pity him in any way, but it's just a dumb sequence where, oh no, Ensign Hawk. We thought he was going to live. He had nothing. He was just a guy on the ship. Ensign Lynch was just as interesting. They get Zefram back on his ship after he tries to run away. And then we have this interesting little exchange between him and Riker. Right here. Where he is also enamored with it. They're all enamored with this guy. And we talked about, we have an A story for Picard, a B story for Data, and the C story is actually for Zefram Cochrane. It's him coming to terms with being a hero.
Dang it. You want to know what my vision is? Dollar signs. Money. I didn't build this ship to usher in a new era for humanity. You think I want to go to the stars? I don't even like to fly. I take trains. I built this ship so that I could retire to some tropical island filled with naked women. That's Zefram Cochrane. That's his vision. This other guy you keep talking about, this historical figure, I never met him. I can't imagine I ever will.
Someone once said, don't try to be a great man, just be a man, and let history make its own judgments.
It's rhetorical nonsense. Who said that?
You did, 10 years from now. You got 58 minutes, Doc.
All right, so as we see Data succumb to the power of the flesh, we see Zefram in our C story realizing that he is now trapped in this fate in some ways. And he comes clean. He says, I didn't want to be a hero on this. I just wanted to be rich and be with naked women and be on an island. It's this admission here. This is his lowest point. He's like, is this really what my future is supposed to be? All of you are so in love with this person who I'm not. And we have this, it's echoed a little bit with Data, who is becoming a person that he's not, this with his skin here. And Picard trying to shed this person who he is. But for Zefram, it's almost this horrible fate for him that he knows he's going to have to be famous and lauded and deified. And he just wants to be a man. So it's a nice little moment there for him. All right, so we have our other two stories now at their low points. Let's get to the bread and butter of this movie, shall we? Let's get to Alfrey and Patrick Stewart just tearing it up with some good acting here. Picard is refusing to blow up the ship. He's calling Worf a coward. If you were any other man, I'd kill you where you stand. And he goes into his ready room to build a phaser. I don't know what the hell he's doing. And no one will go in to challenge him except Alfrey. And here it comes. Man, I should start a Kickstarter for internet, right? Here we go.
Shit! I saw the look on your face when you shot those Borg on the holodeck. You were almost enjoying it.
How dare you?
Oh, come on, Captain. You're not the first man to get a thrill from murdering someone. I see it all the time.
Get out!
Or what? You'll kill me? Like you killed Ensign Lynch?
There was no way to save him.
You didn't even try. Where was your evolved sensibility then?
I don't have time for this.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your little quest. Captain Ahab has to go hunt his whale.
What?
You do have books in the 24th century.
This is not about revenge.
Liar!
This is about saving the future of humanity!
Jean-Luc, blow up the damn ship!
No! No!
All right, I want to break. I'm going to play three different clips here. It's all the same thing, but I want to break up the three different parts. So this is part one, where Lily finally calls out Picard. So having been on the ship for enough time and observed both at his normal state, where he is the teacher and the mentor, and seeing him slowly become consumed by this vengeance against the Borg, she is finally able to call him out on his irrationality. And she does it expertly. With only a little bit of evidence, she is saying, this doesn't make any sense. If you are truly the captain of these people, and you have to take care of these people, you need to blow up this ship because you have not been yourself. And she pushes Jean-Luc Picard to violence, not against her, but he destroys the little ships there behind the glass. All right, so that's the first section. Here comes the second section.
The Enterprise. We've made too many compromises already, too many retreats. They invade our space, and we fall back. They assimilate entire worlds, and we fall back. Not again. The line must be drawn here! This far, no farther! And I will make them pay for what they've done!
That's part two. So part two is Jean-Luc Picard finally saying it. What he wants in this is, I will make them pay for what they've done to me. That's the operative thing. How they violated him. How they made him kill 13,000 people. Lily pushes him so he can finally pull off the mask you seek, Mosaka, And be his just released id and say, I am so hurt still. I am so angry. I am so violated by what they did. I will make them pay for this. So that is his rebuttal to Lily. And so Lily, instead of shouting at him. Walks over to the display case.
You broke your little ships. See you around, Ahab.
And he piled upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the rage and hate felt by his whole race. If his chest had been a cannon, he would have shot his heart upon it.
What?
Moby Dick?
Actually, I never read it.
have spent years hunting the white whale that crippled him. The quest for vengeance. But in the end, it destroyed him and his ship.
I guess he didn't know when to quit.
Picard sets down his phaser rifle. Walks out to his crew and says,
prepare to evacuate the Enterprise.
Boom. What a great sequence there. All right, this is part three. And here she calls him out and says, you broke your little ships. See you around, Ahab. And it's this that finally snaps him back. And then we get, he realizes through this analogy of Herman Melville's Moby Dick that she's trying to put together, and all of the evidence she brought, that yes, he is being consumed by his rage. And it's right there. He broke his ships, and now he's threatening to do it again, his ship and his crew. And this allows him to conquer his demons. And he does that by quoting Melville. Actually, he misquotes Melville. And the actual quote, well, I could give it to you, but why don't we have special guest star Armin Shimerman give you this version of it? Armin?
All that most maddens and torments, all that stirs up the lees of things, all truth with malice in it, all that cracks the sinews and cakes the brain, all the subtle demonisms of life and thought, all evil, to crazy Ahab, were visibly personified and made practically assailable in Moby Dick. He piled upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the general rage and hate felt by his whole race from Adam down. And then, as if his chest had been a mortar, he burst his hot heart shell upon it.
Outstanding. As usual, he's out in Utah right now doing the Utah Shakespeare Festival, and I asked him to do this. Melville is misquoted twice in Star Trek movies. It's misquoted by Khan, and now it's misquoted by Picard. But I can see why they did it, because the original quote, as you heard, is a little more 19th century. So this got the point across. It is a little strange that they so easily misquote Melville, but Herman Melville in Moby Dick, but you would never touch a Shakespeare line. But this gets the point across, and this is why Lily is such a great counterpart for him. She's the one who can heal him by calling him out. Could there have been other members of the crew who could have done that? Could have Beverly or Deanna or Worf or any of those people call him out? Possible. But what's nice about this is that Lily starts out with a blank slate. There's not 7 years and a movie, a backstory between them, where Picard can do whataboutisms and says, well, this and that, and you know, you were there. She's just seeing this on the surface. And what she saw is a man go from a teacher and a mentor to a crazed, vengeance-driven maniac. And then he comes back and teaches Lily a little bit about Moby Dick, even though she never read it. It's a great scene. Okay, so from there, we get Picard and the Borg. They launch the ship. They launch the Phoenix. A lot of fun. It gets the nacelles that pop out. Picard says goodbye to Lily. It's a little strange to get rid of her, but Picard needs to confront his final demon, which is this Borg queen. It's a little bit of a constructed thing. It's a little bit of a retcon where he sees her, and then we say, oh, she was always there. You were always there. But she actually wasn't. He offers to exchange myself for Data. She says yes, but then Data says no. I'm with her. I'm kind of truncating. I'm moving forward. This part here is a little perfunctory. Data then hits the coolant and spills it all out. And then we have a third act action sequence where Jean-Luc Picard has incredible upper body strength and can lift himself up on these weird pipes. And not only that, but also lift up the Borg Queen until Data pulls her down and destroys her and turns her back into the little Terminator skull and spine. So I'm glossing over that because it's pretty perfunctory stuff, and I don't have a lot of notes to that, but I do like this moment right here. Afterwards, when Picard comes up to Data, he says, "How are you?" Here we go.
0.68 seconds.
No, that's not it. That's not it. Where did it go? Did that wrong. Okay, so he breaks. He breaks the Borg, and he goes over to Data.
Captain. Data.
You all right?
I would imagine I look worse than I feel. Strange. Part of me is sorry she's dead.
She was unique.
She brought me closer to humanity than I ever thought possible. And for a time, I was tempted by her offer.
How long a time?
0.68 seconds, sir. For an android, that is nearly an eternity.
Great little sequence there. All right, so this concludes Jean-Luc Picard's arc, where he has conquered his demons and, in an action sequence, bested the Queen, along with Data, who has also completed his arc. Now, he has paid... With Jean-Luc Picard, he pays for it with some of his dignity and some of his you know, he had to basically strip away his mask, that we say, his suit of armor, in order to realize that he was still harboring all this anger towards the Borg. For Data, he literally had to strip away the skin from his body with this coolant. And as we see him here, for his quest for this, for submitting for 0.868 seconds, giving into this temptation, he loses it all. He had to give up all the flesh which they gave him. But in doing so, he becomes more human. The moment I love is, he says, "I imagine I look a lot worse than I..." And then he catches himself and laughs. Feel. That is his most human moment, isn't it? Again, it's so contextually driven where he stumbles upon it and he's able to laugh at a little bit himself, just as we do. That these are these character moments which are so much different from from Generations and later on movies that propel this film forward. So we've closed off those two stories, and now we have Cochrane, after the Borg are defeated, and then the ship lands. These aliens are always referenced as aliens because the big surprise is they are Vulcans. And finally, Zefram Cochrane goes out, and he goes out and shakes the hand of the Vulcans, even though somehow they know English, and they say live long and prosper, and he just holds out his hand and says thanks. And finally, he is resolving his story because he is finally ready to embrace his future. He's finally ready to be that hero, that deified person that everyone's going to look up to. He's ready to accept this future that is inevitable for him in some ways. And then we seal it all off with a wonderful goodbye. Let's see. Yeah, right over here. Between Picard and Lily.
Riker Enterprise, stand by to beam us up.
You gotta go?
I envy you. The world you're going to.
I envy you. Taking these first steps into a new frontier. I shall miss you, Lily.
Ugh, so good. There was supposed to be a kiss between
them. Doctor Enterprise, Energize.
But they cut it. And I agree with it wholeheartedly. This was enough. So in the scene, they just stare at each other as emotional equals. And they both have to go back to their own time. She has to go back to the repaired present, and he has to go back to his future. It's bittersweet. But you don't need a kiss, because it's not that kind of romance they had. They had one that was through crazy circumstances, and they're somewhere between friends and the starting of a relationship, but they've run out of time. So Picard leans forward and gives her a kiss on the cheek, and you see, the thing I love about with Alfred Woodward's reaction to this is she just sort of inches her cheek closer to him as though, I could just slide my lips over and kiss you. And that's all that's needed. That's all this story needs, because it's moving so fast, and these are people doing their jobs, and we don't need to stop the bus to get off and have a romance story. The romance is being built in there. You didn't need the kiss. So they cut out a kiss also in Insurrection. We'll talk about that too. They get back on the ship, and everything's
report. The moon's gravitational field
pretty hunky-dory. You know, I mean,
Vulcans did not detect us.
Captain, I've reconfigured our warp field to match the chronometric readings of the Borg sphere.
Recreate the vortex, Commander.
Aye, sir.
All decks report ready.
Helm standing by.
Mr. Data, laying a course for the 24th century. I suspect our future is there waiting for us.
Course laid in, sir.
Make it so.
And with that, they pull back, and they pull out, and they head back to the future. As Lily watches. And it's a beautiful moment, ruined by Ooby Dooby. I hate Ooby Dooby. I'm sorry. Even the writers in the audio commentary, they hate Ooby Dooby. I think it's a bad song. All right. That was the film. Part 3. Star Trek First Contact, as I said, came out November 22nd, 1966, close to my birthday. It made $146 million. That's $26 million more than Generations. And more importantly, overwhelmingly positive reviews. Comparing it to Wrath of Khan. It also bridged into a larger fan base. Whereas Generations was a folded unto itself fanboy film, First Contact had enough scares and romance and excitement to bring in other people. Not as widely as Star Trek IV, but certainly with time travel, with things that we can understand being set on Earth, and with monsters, it gave people enough of a reference so that they could say, oh, I saw that. I like that. Maybe I'll watch the next one. Maybe I'll watch Next Generation or Deep Space Nine. It gave people that gateway, which is what these movies should do, especially when you have 800 episodes of TV shows. The film, in my mind, succeeded because, as I alluded to before, your heroes are always moving forward towards a goal. They are not sitting back passively trying to prevent a villain from doing stuff. I went through it all in Star Trek 1. It is V'ger, which is coming towards them. They have to stop. In Star Trek 2, it is Kirk who has to stop Khan from destroying stuff. And the stakes are his ship and his crew and his son. In Star Trek 3, it gets a little muddy because we're following Krug a little more, and they're trying to get Spock to a certain place. Star Trek 4, it works because they're trying to save the world. The stakes are high enough there. It's about the world. Star Trek 5, it's about Cybok trying to go to see God. What are the stakes on that? Cybok trying to go see God. What if they never did that and Cybok just went to go see God? I mean, what would happen? It's just a little dumb ghost that can be destroyed by disruptor fire. So these stakes are big enough, and they're also personal enough, and we have villains which we have to stop by doing things. So that's why this film, I feel succeeded. For me personally, I was trying to dig back and figure out exactly who I saw this with. I think it may be with my friend of the pod, Matt Stomping Thompson, 1996. For me, there's a little bit of first contact in this as well for me in my life, because in 1996, I moved to San Diego. I moved away from Michigan and moved to San Diego. And I didn't know anyone there. I had an a cappella quartet, and we'd just broken up, literally like a couple months before. I'd broken up with my girlfriend probably like a month before that. And I moved to San Diego, and I was working at SeaWorld. Everything was new. It was first contact for me in some ways. I do have some niggling thoughts that this is very much a Star Trek light. It is sort of a Cliff Notes version. But again, because Picard is not necessarily acting like Picard, the Borg have been retconned a little bit. You have a Borg queen. But if it got people to enjoy Star Trek, I was okay with it. And the more I watch it now, the more I can see the emotional content of it is so strong. It is worth it to take a few steps back in the plot, and the continuity, and the canon in order to move forward with these characters. And every single character in the show moves forward a little bit. It's a brilliantly conceived and constructed and executed film. And Jonathan Frakes, for it being his first time out of the gate, just nails it. It is both functional as far as getting the action out, but has just enough artistry in the shots to make you feel like it's a big budget film. If you want to see further ripples of this film, you can watch Enterprise for their episode Resurrection. It's okay. It's where they find the Borg in the Arctic. You can also see a different version of what happens during first contact with Zefram Cochrane in Through a Mirror Darkly. That's definitely a very fun thing. The rest of the episode carries out very differently, but the opening is very, very fun. In the end, as we wrap this up, and thank you for listening to this, this was a chance for Star Trek and the Next Generation to return back to their roots, to return back to what works, which is the characters, and putting obstacles in front of the characters so that they could find stuff within them. They didn't have to solve the world's problems. They just had to figure out who they were. All right, my name is Mike McCafferty. I'm playing this out here because for them, it was a chance for them to make first contact with the audience, to go back in time and reintroduce themselves to us. And this time, they succeeded. All right. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. Like, comment, and subscribe and do all that stuff. Check out our Facebook page. And tune in the next couple weeks as we move forward to find out what happens when you have villains with stretchy skin, Gilbert and Sullivan, and Haystacks, Insurrection. I'm Mike McCafferty with Armin Shimerman, and I just want to talk about Star Trek.